Well, Rod, first I've got to say a massive thank you for taking your time for doing this today.
Great pleasure.
All right, first I'm going to talk about the new album that you've got coming out. The album's called Still Got That Hunger. What was the inspiration behind the new album?
Well, really, just the fact that we wanted to make a new album. It's been about 3 or 4 years since we've been into the studio. And it's very important to us always. While we love, we honestly do, while we love playing the old stuff like Time the Season, you know, and She's Not There, and the Odyssey and Oracle stuff, we really still love playing that, and we love rediscovering some of the old Zombies catalogue that maybe we didn't even play live the first time round. But one of the things that keeps giving us energy is the excitement of being able to create and record new material. I think that everybody in the band is better than they've ever been. I think Colin's voice sounds great. We still love exploring harmonies, and we still love exploring songwriting and songs, and moving things forward. It's that really gives us excitement more than anything else, and that's really why we feel we have to keep recording and creating, really, because that's certainly what I'm in it for, and always have been. And you know, hence the title, Still Got That Hunger, even though it's actually taken from a line in one of the tracks on the album called Chasing the Past.
What was it like making this album, say, compared to your earlier works?
It was surprisingly similar, because we deliberately tried to revisit the process that we would, the best parts of the process that we would always, you know, embrace, if you like, many years ago. In other words, because recording technology over the years has obviously changed so much, and there's so much more you can do now. You can you can have unlimited tracks. You can you know, use drum loops. You can record instrument by instrument. You can go over each little overdub with a fine tooth comb. We thought, that's all great, and it's great to use all that when you need to, but what we wanted to recapture was that sense of performance that you get when you get five people in the room at the same time. So we deliberately, I wrote all the songs but one on this album. So what I would do, I would first of all teach the top line to Colin, and then I'd have ideas for harmonies and things, but we would go into rehearsal just like we had to in the old days, because there was no other way of doing it, and work out the structure of each track, including the vocals and the harmonies, all at the same time in rehearsal. And that's what we did, and then it was really important to us to go into the recording studio and record as much as possible, everything at once, so that what you get is a real interplay between each of the musicians, because you're listening to what's going on and you're unconsciously reacting to everything that you're hearing at that millisecond. And including, our original idea was to have Colin always sing a guide vocal, with the idea that he would then replace the vocal. You know, we'd have a day to really work on the vocal and replace it. But do you know what? It worked so well, this process. It was so enjoyable and exciting to do, that almost every vocal that we used on the album came from Colin's live vocals that we just thought were guides. And we didn't necessarily use all of one track of Colin's vocals, but, you know, we did comp up the best bits if there was a particularly good bit from another take. But we would always use Colin's live vocal that he sang when he was reacting to what we were playing, and we were reacting to what he was singing, and we were reacting to each other. And that includes the solos. The solos are virtually done live as well. We might have cleaned up little bits and pieces. But, you know, we really, I feel, captured some of the essence that we used to do because of the recording process in the old days. When you couldn't do anything else, you only had four tracks, so you had to record in that way. And because of that, it was a hugely enjoyable experience, actually.
And one of the good things about this is it went through Pledge Music, so you were getting fans to obviously help towards the project, but a good percentage of that also went to the charity Music Unites.
Yep.
How did you get involved in Music Unites?
Through our American management company. They told us about it. They said this would be a good thing to hook up with because it's really worthwhile. And we went along a couple of times and we gave a little concert to them at one point, and then they prepared a version of Time of the Season, which was lovely, and they sang it to us. And then I said, come on, let's do it together. And we played and sang together with them, with their arrangement and us playing as well. It was lovely, actually. And, you know, anything that can actually help these kids really have a purpose. I mean, one thing Colin and I often talk about is the fact that because we were, A, in love with rock and roll music when we were 15 and 16 years old, and younger, actually, but that's when we started the band, it gave us a focal point. It gave us something, somewhere to put our energies, so that you didn't, you know, you've got so much energy and hormones flying around at that age, and it's easy to go off the track, you know, off the rails. But when you've got a real focus and something that you love doing, and you've got a purpose, because it's so hard to find a purpose at that age, it's invaluable. And anything that can help the kids do that and discover music and get some sense of purpose in their lives at that age, I think it's fantastic, and we all really like the idea.
That's fantastic. I think it is a fantastic charity, so definitely I think it's worth people looking out for it and sponsoring it as well.
Yeah, brilliant.
Okay, I'm going to talk a bit more about the new stuff again in a moment, but I've got to talk about your relationship with Colin, because you've known each other for so many years. I mean, what is it that's actually kept you two as friends for all this time?
Well, we must have naturally got on with each other from the beginning, because you can't stay friends that long without that. But I actually met Colin on our first rehearsal. I mean, I was desperate to form a band, and I asked a friend of mine who was building a bass, never played a note in his life, it wasn't Chris, I have to say, actually, if he wanted to be in a band. He said, yeah. And he said, no, I've got a mate who plays guitar and sings a bit. I said, well, bring him along. And that was Colin. And I was supposed to be the lead singer. We went along, started our first rehearsal, and it went, you know, reasonably well. And then I wandered over to a beaten-up old piano. This was in 1961. I wandered up over to a beaten-up old piano that was out of tune and flat, and I started playing Nut Rocker, the Bee Bundle and the Stingers hit at the time. And Colin came racing over and said, I can't believe that. He said, that's brilliant. He said, you've got to play piano in the band. I said, no, the band's supposed to be guitars, aren't they? And I wasn't at all sure about this, so I wandered away. And then about 20 minutes later, we had a coffee break, and Colin picked up a guitar and started singing an old Ricky Nelson song. Now, I still can't remember what it is. It might have been It's Late or I'll Never Get Over You or something like that. But I was gobsmacked. I thought it sounded fantastic. And I said to him, look, I can't believe this. I said, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to be lead singer. You be lead singer, and I'll play piano. And that was it. And from that point onwards, we were firm friends. I'd written one song, and actually I'd written one song for a local band that they actually recorded in Olympic Studios, believe it or not. I didn't find that out until years later. And the second song I wrote was just before we turned professional in 64, called It's All Right With Me. And then we were going to record Summertime for our first single with Decca Records. And our producer said, why don't you try and write something for the session? So I went away and wrote She's Not There. And Chris went away and wrote You Make Me Feel Good, which turned out to be the B-side. And from that time onwards, I was continually writing songs, obviously, for Colin's voice, for harmonies as well, but generally for Colin's voice. And we always like to say that I grew up learning to write songs with Colin's voice in mind, and Colin grew up learning to sing by singing my songs. So that cemented something. And even though we split up for the first time in 1967, we stayed working together. I mean, I co-produced his first solo album 1 year, which had So You Don't Mind, which is a huge European hit and UK hit on it. And several of his albums, played on lots of his albums, and we remained in touch over the years. But, you know, the original Zombies split up in 67, and we formed again, Colin and I, not initially as the Zombies again, just because I did a charity show for John Dankworth, who sadly passed away now, but that was in late 1999. And Colin got up on stage and sang Time of the Season, and She's Not There, just unannounced, just got up and sang. And it was so nice, the feeling, that we decided just for fun to do half a dozen, that's it, concerts together. And after, we had such a ball that very, very, very gradually we started working together, and then over a period of time started to reintroduce some old Zombie stuff because we realised we hadn't played a lot of that the first time round. And eventually, you know, became a full-fledged version of the Zombies again with all the same, I can't think of the word, you know, ambitions for each song, for what we were doing than we had when we started out. You know, we're doing it all for the same reasons now. In no way are we doing it to make a buck. In fact, when we first got together, we did about 3 tours to the States where we actually just broke even with all the hassle that's involved in that. But we did it just because it felt like such a buzz to do it.
Brilliant. I mean, you mentioned a bit about your first single, She's Not There, and that song actually came out before you even turned 20. So what was that like hitting fame before you were... Well, what was it like hitting fame when you were still a teenager?
It was like a dream. It was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I was in love with music since almost I was born, actually. Initially classical music, because I didn't like the pop music that was around in the early 50s, until I heard Elvis's early stuff, which just blew me away. And that turned me on to rock and roll. And at the time, you know, I was about 11 when I heard Elvis, and he seemed like, you know, America seemed like a magic land, and Elvis seemed like this alien creature, you know, that I could never have anything to do with or aspire to. It was just so far away from our experience. It was just unbelievable. And in those days, America was such a different place to England. You know, if you went out, I mean, the first time I went to New York, I'll get off the subject now, but the first time I went to New York, seeing the all the American cars there, they were so different to anything that we had in England. You know, the whole culture was totally, totally different. So America seemed unattainable. And then there we were, just 7 years later, recording a song which went on to be number one in Cashbox in America, number three in Billboard. Cashbox was an equivalent magazine at the time. The first number one after the Beatles to become number one with a self-written song by a band, made the 9 o'clock news. I later found out that Elvis himself had 3 of my songs on his jukebox. I mean, it was... I can't tell you what a dream it was. It was magical. And to be that age and have that going on, you know, it really is dreamlike. It's something you can hardly imagine. Because I've written a song on the new album, and one of the verses goes, can I remember this? I walked into the Brooklyn Fox that snowy Christmas day, because it was in Christmas Day 1964 we started in America. I walked into the Brooklyn Fox that snowy Christmas day, and Patti and her bluebells that was Patti LaBelle, simply stole my heart away. She took me to Aretha Franklin, showed me so much soul, and helped us join the party with our English rock and roll. And that's exactly what happened. Patti LaBelle, that was before she was, you know, the huge rhythm and blues artist that she became with LaBelle, but it was, you know, it's the same people. And these fantastic black acts that we were idolising, like Benny King, the Drifters, they took us to their hearts. Chuck Jackson was on, you know, Patti LaBelle, obviously. Patti LaBelle did say, listen, you've got to check out this woman called Aretha Franklin. That was just before she started doing all her soul stuff. And she told us about Nina Simone. It was a very magical time.
Okay, I've got to talk about one of my... This is probably my favourite song from the band, and that was Time of the Season. That's a song that I think I must hear almost everywhere all the time, because it's a song that's just iconic. It's very 60s kind of track. What was it like when you first wrote that song?
It was written very quickly. We needed one more song for Odyssey and Oracle, which was our self-produced album. It was very important to us that we produce that ourselves to get our own ideas across. It was written very quickly, recorded very quickly. I remember being in the studio, and Colin hadn't learned it properly. He hadn't heard it very, very long. And we had a real argument in the studio. There's lots of swearing going on. And I was saying, no, Colin, could you just, you know, try it like this? And he said, look, if you're so bloody, could you come up here and do it? And I said, oh, come on, Colin, you know, it'll be great. Just, you know, so all that was going on. And then he was singing, it's the time of the season for loving, you know. But we loved it when we did it. I always thought it could be a hit. It turned out to be number one in almost every country in the world, apart from the dear old UK, where it, in spite of being released three times, it has never charted in any way. But having said that, as you say, everybody knows it here. We played it at Glastonbury, and the crowd went wild, went absolutely mad. Somehow, it continues to be played on the radio. It's become an iconic track, and yet it's never been a hit over here. Almost everywhere else in the world. That's very strange. But it's often been used in films like Awakenings to typify, you know, a certain part of the era. It's been used many times in adverts, in films, and it is loved all over the world, and I'm so grateful.
And another thing I've got to mention about that song is that a couple of years ago it was used on Eminem's most recent album for one of his tracks. And what did you think of it being used for that song?
I love what he did, and I'll tell you why. Because it was great to hear something which was genuinely creative. You know, it wasn't just a cover, it wasn't just taking something off the back of Time of the Season. Even though he used loads of it in his track, you know, the sampling was very heavy. He used even some of our vocals as well as the rhythm track. But the way he turned it, it's the time of the season for loving, into something which was sonically alike. You know, there's no rhyme or no reason for nothing, but absolutely inverting the sense was very clever, and I really, really liked that right from the start.
Got to also make a mention about your other band that you done in the 70s, Argent, which basically that came straight after the Zombies. So what was that like? Was that a different experience taking on that band compared to the Zombies?
It was a different experience, for many reasons, actually. I mean, inevitably, when you've got different people in the band, it's different. It fashions how the band is. We were in the Zombies. You may not think this, but when you think what the Beatles were doing at the time in the late 60s before they broke up, they were really pushing boundaries. I think they were the first progressive group because they were always pushing musical boundaries and changing things. And trying to be creative and move forward and try and find new paths, etc., etc. We were always trying to do that as well. That's really why, obviously, an Oracle sounds very different to the very early stuff that we did. You know, you're just experimenting. You're trying different things. You're drinking in everything that's around you. We carried on that with Argent. Chris White, the original bass player in the Zombies, was still heavily involved. In fact, he wrote the majority of Hold Your Head Up, strangely enough. Most people think it was me, but the majority of that was written by Chris. He heard Argent in an early gig play Time of the Season, and we went into a riff. We improvised a riff that we'd never played before, and he loved it and wrote a song around it, and that turned out to be Hold Your Head Up. And Chris was co-producer with me and co-writer with me of Argent, so we had a real link with the Zombies. The Zombies broke up because in the UK we'd only ever had one hit. She's Not There, and our live earnings were going down so much that the people that weren't writers in the band, everyone apart from Chris and me, didn't have any money. Chris and me were doing very well because we'd had lots of hits around the world, but the live work in the UK and travelling was so much harder in those days. It's just not like it is now. You know, it was a commercial decision completely. So it wasn't through any bad feeling that we broke up. We broke up for commercial reasons. So Chris was involved in the Argent project, but the musicians were different, and it starts to to fashion the path that you go forward. Also, the 70s was a different time. There were different things going on. You know, you follow paths and thoughts and ideas. And it's just different because of those reasons. But, you know, we still had the same passion and hunger for what we were doing.
Okay, and also I've got to make a mention to another member of your band, Russ Ballard, who wrote the song God Gave Rock and Roll to You, which has become, like some of your songs with the Zombies, has become very iconic and a song that's heard all around the world. So what was it like recording that song?
When Russ brought that, you know, because with all our songs, we used to work them in rehearsal and people would put in ideas and maybe, you know, change things about them. When Russ first brought that song in, it was a straightforward rock and roll song. It was, God gave rock and roll to you, rock and roll, but it was like that. And I suggested halving the time, you know, making it much more anthemic. So that little bit of it was my idea. But, I mean, obviously the whole song is totally Russ's. All the chords, all the melody. We liked it very much when it first came out. It irks me a bit that that Gene Simmons sometimes claims he wrote that song, whereas all he did was change the words and two couplets in the song for the American market. But, you know, yeah, you're right. It's totally a Russ Ballard song.
Another thing I've got to mention is that you're actually part of Ringo Starr and his all-star band. I mean, what conversation actually happened for you to become part of that?
It had actually been mentioned a couple of times before, and for one reason or another, I could never do it. And actually, since that tour, it was mentioned again. And again, I couldn't do it. But that year, I could. And it was great. I've always loved Ringo's drumming. I've always loved his feel. He has a slight swing to his drumming, which maybe comes from the transition of, you know, rock and roll coming out of jazzier things. There's just something indefinable about his drumming that I've always loved, and it was great to play with him. Never met him before. I don't know why. We'd never run across each other. I know that at one of the first press conferences, they said, it must be great for you to hook up with Rod Argent again. He said, I've never met him before. And I said, no, absolutely. You know, this is the first time we've met. But when we started, it was great. Working with Edgar Winter, what a fantastic musician. I shared a dressing room with Edgar. It was great. And everybody on that tour was superb, actually. Hamish on bass from the Average White Band originally. Sheila E., Prince's percussionist. Richard Marks, Billy Squire. It was a great show. Great time.
Okay, all right, so I've got to go back onto the new stuff now, because you got the album out in a few weeks' time,
yeah.
And you're also going to be touring as well later in the autumn. Are you looking forward to getting back on the road again?
Oh, 100%. It's going to be hard. We're going to... I mean, I leave around the end of September to go to the States, and we're going to be doing... in the States, we're going to be doing a two-part show, you know, two halves. The first half is going to be the band that Colin and I have put together over these last few years, which is sounding really fabulous, which is the band on the album, on the new album. In the second half, we've put back together the original bass player and drummer, along with the keyboard player from the Brian Wilson Band, to take care of the overdubs. That I did on the original Odyssey and Oracle album, and we're going to be doing Odyssey and Oracle, premiering it in the States for the first time. We did that in Shepherd's Bush in 2008 over here. But we're going to be reproducing every note in sequence on the Odyssey and Oracle album, right from Care of Self 44, the first track, through to Time of the Season at the end. And, you know, it's going to be a really, really major production. So we're doing that for about 6 weeks. We come back, go to France, Spain, then we do a UK tour. It's going to be very intense right up until the end of the year, really.
Over the years, you've done countless number of shows, but has there ever been anything that's happened at a concert that's really stuck with you? Maybe something quite funny or something quite amusing has happened?
Right, just off the top of my head, I remember, this is going back many, many years, I remember on one of the early tours in America, I mean, getting to America was a a really big kerfuffle in those days. And, you know, getting immigration clearance, getting visa clearance, getting... at the time, you had to... I think we went in exchange with Duke Ellington Band, and along with other English artists. You know, they would only allow English musicians to go over if there was an American musician who was coming over to England as well. So all that was gone through, and we were really late, and we travelled virtually 24 hours to get to this first show. We were completely knackered. I rushed onto this high stage. I had no idea, you know, to do out in the show, which was like a package show with maybe 20 acts on it or something like that. So we were only going to do about two or three songs. And I remember rushing onto the stage, sitting down on this stool by this keyboard that I'd never seen before. And the keyboard and the stool collapsed, and I fell off the side of the stage. That was my introduction to that whole American tour, which got better, I have to say. And that's just one thing off the top of my head there.
Oh,
there's one other thing, again off the top of my head.
Yep.
I always remember on the first Dick Clark tour that we did in the States, we were playing with a lot of black acts on the tour, really fabulous, and some white acts too. But in those days, I mean, unbelievably, because this was 1965, generally, the white acts, believe it or not, even in the music business, this wasn't a set rule, but the black acts still gravitated towards the back of the bus and the coach, you know, and the white acts gravitated to the front. So being, you know, sort of young and thinking, you know, we're not standing for this, they saved us a seat at the front, but we walked to the back, and there were Colin and I, and there were two seats left, one on one side and one on the other. One was the lead singer of the Velvetettes, who was very beautiful, called Carolyn, on the other side was her chaperone, who was a much, much bigger lady, shall we say, and much older. And Colin grabbed the seat next to Karen, and I was left with the seat beside Miss Ship, who was the... I spent the whole of the tour in, you know, the less favourable seat, shall we say. And then we had a sort of rite of passage, because within the first couple of days, particularly the black hats, I mean, maybe the other white hats had gone through this because we joined it a little bit after the others were on, but they were always singing, and they sang, you know, each of the act would, they say, come on, you sing something, and so they'd sing something great, you know, someone would set up a chord and someone would sing a spiritual or a great R&B thing, and then they suddenly stopped and turned to us and looked at Colin and me and said, okay, you sing something. And we thought, oh, shit. And we just did not know what to do. So right out of the blue, and we never played this on stage ever, I said, Colin, start singing A Hard Day's Night. So he started singing A Hard Day's Night, and I started harmonising with him. And they all applauded afterwards, and we were in after that. So that was great. We sort of passed.
At least they knew who you were. They didn't think you were the Beatles at that point then.
No, they didn't know.
That's all right then. Oh, brilliant. Okay, I've got a couple more questions, Rod. The first of which is, I know you said that you've got a lot of touring coming up, leading up to the end of the year, but have you already started planning for what's going to happen after? Have you got any ideas what you want to do, say, from 2016 onwards?
Well, I only know what's happening at the beginning. First of all, I'm really hoping that we actually get some radio play for the tracks of this album, because I've heard one of the tracks so far. We gave Stuart McConey on Radio 6 a premiere, and we played Chasing the Past, and he got a terrific reaction from the audience, and he got lots of people writing in emails and things saying, this sounds fantastic, I love it, I'm going to buy the album, etc, etc. And he was really, you know, after he played it, he said, because we were there with him, after he played it, he said, oh, we're getting a terrific reaction. He said, listen to some of these, and he read a couple of them out, and he gave us a copy of the rest of the stuff. And the first time you hear something on the radio is always very exciting, because radio has a certain sort of compression. Things sound different on the radio, and you never know how it's going to sound until you hear it, and it's got a little magic about it. But the problem is, with people of our vintage, often we just cannot get the tracks played. When people hear them, they really like them. But, you know, the problem is getting them played, because, and in America too, I remember Ringo saying to me, he said, it's a nightmare. He said, the heritage stations say, oh, no, we don't play new stuff. We'll play all his old stuff, but we don't play his new stuff. And the new stations say, oh, no, he's a heritage act. We only play new acts. And you sort of fall between stools. And so first of all, I just want the album to get a little bit of exposure, the tracks, because I think the album's great, and I just want it, at least people to hear it and make up their own minds, you know, on the radio. So that's my first hope and ambition. The only thing that's in stone for us at the moment is the fact that we've done two of these already before. There's a thing called a Moody Blues Cruise, where the Moody Blues cruise in the Caribbean, and they have other acts on. Like last year, we did it with Roger Daltrey. You know, the Moody's Roger Daltrey we were on, and there were one or two American acts on as well. And they've asked us to do that again this year. So I know we'll be doing that towards the beginning of the year. That's the only thing that's set in stone at the moment. But I'm just really hoping that we can work this album to some degree and just get it out there all over the world. Actually, I mean, we've just come back from Japan and the Philippines, and JVC Victor, which is the RCA Victor equivalent in Asia, and Japan, particularly Japan, they've signed up the album and they're excited about it. I'm just hoping for something to happen and we can follow up the path that creates.
I can definitely tell you now, Rod, that your album is more than, well, it's just going to be played lots and lots on my show, so don't worry about that.
Thank you so much. Well, that is great to hear. Thank you.
Okay, I've got one last question, Rod, and this, I don't know how easy it's going to be for you, because you've worked with loads of different people and you've collaborated with loads of great people, but is there anyone that you would wish that you could still collaborate with?
Oh, my goodness. Do you know, I never think in those terms. It's always very exciting when you do. Even though you can hardly hear me, whenever Who Are You gets played, I'm proud that I'm playing on that track, because it's such a fabulous track. I just don't know. I mean, it would be wonderful to play with someone like Aretha. I'm never going to. I know that there was one thing that happened really unexpectedly about 15 years ago now, it might have been longer, when there was a show singer called Stephanie Lawrence, who sadly died now, but she was doing a little thing on regional TV up in Birmingham, Pebble Mill, and she said to me, look, I've got to sing a couple of songs. She said, but I don't know the band up there at all. She said, would you come up and just play piano for me? And I said, yeah, I'll do that. So I went up there and did that for her. And after we'd done our first song, Phil Everly from the Everly Brothers was on the show. And he came over to me and said, oh, I really like that. He said, would you back me on a song? And I said, oh, geez, yeah, would I? And he said, there's a song that I had a hit with back in the 50s. Now, this is one of my seminal records. He said, it's Let It Be Me. And I thought, oh, shit. You know, to be on, it gave me goosebumps. And I played, I Bless the Day I Found You. Played Let It Be Me with Phil Everly singing. And that felt as magical as the things that I was doing when I first started. that was a really lovely moment.
Oh, well, that's brilliant. And you never know about Aretha Franklin. It could still maybe happen. You might get the call one day.
Well, who knows? But she is a great pianist herself. So why would she? But nevertheless, I mean, she's just such a wonderful artist. That would be great. There are probably some great, great new artists I haven't heard. I'm terrible. That's probably when people get older. A lot of people, you stick with all the stuff that you've loved over the years, and you tend not to listen to so much new ones. But I mean, Aretha was one of the people that blew me away. Along with Ray Charles, along with Stevie Wonder, along with just various people through the years. I remember seeing the duet album that Tony Bennett did. I don't know, and he did a duet with it was all videoed, and I watched it, and it was fabulous. I mean, there he is, 85, and he still sounds great. And he sang a great version of The Lady is a Tramp with Lady Gaga, and she was brilliant. And it just amazed me. And at the end of it, he sang a duet with Aretha. And at the end of it, here was this guy, still singing great, 85 or whatever he is, and as they were getting towards the end of the duet, you could see a tear roll down his cheek, and I thought, that's what it's all about. You know, to retain that passion and still have the same feelings about what you're doing when you're in your mid-80s. Well, you know, what's bad?
Fantastic. Well, Rod, once again, just a absolutely massive thank you. I can't even say how much I've been looking forward to this, because this has just been a great interview. It's been really great to finally get to chat to you, sir.
Oh, bless you. Thank you very much.
And I can't wait to hear the new album. Can't wait to... I'm hoping to one day come and see you guys live, because I've made that a promise to myself for many years, and it's going to happen at some point.
Absolutely. Brilliant.
All right. Well, all the best. All the best for the new album. All the best for the touring. And take care and goodbye.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Bye.
See you again. Bye.